You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. Today is Veterans Day, a day when the nation honors its military veterans. On today's program, we'll be talking about the 100th anniversary of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery and the non-combat contributions the military has made to the U.S. throughout history, including those in healthcare. But up front, since November 11, 1921, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier has served as the heart of Arlington National Cemetery. It is the final resting place for three unidentified American service members. There are commemorations at the Tomb of the Unknown today, but here to talk about the history is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Conrad Crane, Chief of Historical Services and Support at the Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. Dr. Crane, thank you for being with us today. What happened on this day 100 years ago at Arlington National Cemetery?
Well, 100 years ago today was the internment of a unknown soldier from World War I. In March of 2021, Congress had passed a bill to create the memorial at Arlington National Cemetery. In Europe, there were four major cemeteries at the end of World War I, four major American cemeteries. One unknown was selected from each cemetery and placed in a hotel in France, and a decorated non-commissioned officer came in with a white rose and was told to select one of the four coffins. He circled them. Eventually, he selected the third coffin from the left because he said it pulled to him like it was a buddy who knew him. Laid the rose in that coffin. That one was selected. It was sent to the United States. It was interred on November 11th, 1921, in a ceremony attended by President Harding, Vice President Coolidge, members of Congress. There was a solemn march through Washington of the coffin that thousands watched. The coffin was interred again on November 11th, 1921. Now, the actual tomb, the way it is now, wasn't constructed until the 1930s. 1932 is when it was finished. But the initial interment was in November 11th. There were some changes afterwards. Initially it was just it wasn't guarded the way it is today. It was just a setting out there on its own with a white level marker on the tomb. The American Legion complained that they didn't think it was being treated with proper respect. Again, Congress created a much more elaborate tomb by 1932, and the Army started to guard it. Initially, the Army didn't want to guard it, but they eventually accepted that mission, and we'll talk about that. That is probably every American needs to go to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and watch the precision and the honor that is bestowed at that particular location. It is truly inspiring. And again, it evolved over time. It started out with the World War I unknown. After Korea and World War II, there were World War II and Korea unknowns added. There was actually a Vietnam unknown at one time, but there was some very sloppy forensics on that one. And eventually that individual was identified as an Air Force lieutenant with modern forensic technology, but that fourth crypt is empty, that one has been kept that way now as a symbol of all the unknowns from all wars for that. So there are three unknowns interred, but there's also an open spot that is a symbol for again all the unknowns from all wars.
A few things just wanted to add to what you were saying. That ceremony on November 11th, 1921, with President Harding, former President Wilson was there, Woodrow Wilson. We have video of that on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. The description of today's program, you can see that video. What was the symbolism? What was the idea behind it when Congress came up with this idea before 1921?
Well, again, that they passed the bill in March of 2021. Obviously, the symbolism is just respect for the sacrifice of soldiers on foreign soil, and the fact that even, you know, that they'll be, even though we don't exactly know who they are, that the nation remembers and how it values each of its war, and the value on each of its war dead, and what they, and the appreciation for the sacrifice that is involved. And, you know, it is, you know, as Abraham Lincoln said, you know, that last full measure of devotion, the sacrifice, that last full measure of devotion, and how much the nation appreciates that.
Has there ever been any speculation about the identity of those that are entombed? You mentioned that an Air Forceman was identified as one of the unknowns, but throughout history, has there been speculation as to who actually is buried there?
Well, that's been a little thorny issue, I guess. But then no one has brought up about disinterring the three remains that are there to try to identify. Again, modern, you know, there are thousands and thousands of unknowns from the Civil War, for instance, and we'll never identify the issue. You know, some people there's been some talk about perhaps trying to identify with modern forensic techniques some of the others, but it hasn't gotten a whole lot of steam. We haven't had any unknowns, you know, since the attempt for the Vietnam. It's just modern forensics make things a lot different. But again, the honor and respect bestowed upon the war dead has not changed, and I think that broader symbolism has become more important.
Dr. Crane, there are many people who served in the military who served the nation who are buried at Arlington, but yet ceremonies honoring them in total are always at the Tomb of the Unknown. Why?
Well, it's just such a, again, it's hard to explain. It's so powerful. Every American needs to go there. I had the true honor and privilege of getting an inside tour with some of the men and women from the old guard who have that mission. And I would argue that there are no more dedicated soldiers in the world than that particular contingent. Of what they do every day to get ready for their role and as a guard, and the meticulous way they prepare their uniforms, and every movement is carefully choreographed. The same number of steps, the same pattern of turns. When they get inspected, the whole inspection is a ritual between the inspecting officer and the soldiers. It is the ultimate sign of respect and honor for the war dead. I mean, it is. I was almost overwhelmed with the dedication of those particular soldiers. And we actually had, within the last couple of years, the first all-female guard contingent there as well. So it's not just men, it's men and women that are performing that mission. But again, it's just the privilege they really feel privileged to have that mission. It is so, every American should see it. It is just so powerful, and it really brings home about the value, the sacrifice of the war dead, but also the way that the Army especially feels about those war dead. They still are our own.
Yeah, I've been there. I've been to Arlington many times, but to witness the changing of the guard at least twice. And it is such a somber ceremony, and you're right, the precision and the discipline, it just, when you think about it, is just amazing that that happens 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, no matter what the weather is. And it's just incredible that when you do get to see that. You mentioned that the Army at first didn't want to do it. Why not? What's the history there?
Well, it was just that was not in the plans. And it was, you're talking about, you know, a post-war army that was strapped for resources and personnel, and it was not projected. But again, once the army accepted the mission, it embraced it wholeheartedly, and you can see where it's evolved today. But again, that was not in the initial plans for the, it was just going to be another tomb at Arlington. But again, the American Legion got involved with the complaints about that it wasn't being shown the proper respect. And again, it took a little while, but the army came on board fully committed eventually.
And there are commemoration ceremonies going on today at Arlington. President Biden will be putting a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown. And something that doesn't happen, and I don't know whether it's ever happened before, this week, that actually the public could leave a flower at the Tomb of the Unknown, walk by the tomb itself. Do you know of any other plans in the future to bury war veterans, like, say, again from Vietnam or the War on Terror, Afghanistan, Iraq?
Again, with modern forensics, I'm not aware of any unknowns. I mean, it's just we have the technology now to identify all our dead. We also, I mean, it's I just don't. I don't see a situation where we would not be able to do that at this point. And we pay, you know, that the services, all the military services, just we there is nothing more important than taking care of of our casualties, and we are devoted to identifying, you know, getting them, trying to save them if we can't, making sure that their families are well aware of the sacrifice and the costs. And I just don't see a way. I can't foresee a situation with the modern technology where we'll have another unknown. And I don't think the services do either. If we did, perhaps one would be interred. But again, I don't see it. I don't think anyone's planning for that.
Dr. Crane, I have to tell you that I was a little bit hesitant to play taps at the beginning of the program. That taps, by the way, is from Arlington National Cemetery. But I was a little bit hesitant because many people, I don't know if many is the right word, but a lot of people, put it that way, confuse Memorial Day and Veterans Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
And Memorial Day especially, because, and you know, very cognizant of everyone wanting to honor military veterans. Memorial Day is to honor those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for their country who have died in war. Where Veterans Day, how do you see Veterans Day? And do you think about it on a day like this as a military veteran yourself?
Oh, no, you are correct. There's a difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day. And Memorial Day is for the war dead, and Veterans Day is really for those that have continued on and contributed to the country. So I always have considered them different. I understand your hesitancy about TAPS, and we tend to confuse the two. But I'm proud to have been a veteran. My 26 years of active duty were a proud time. I remember I had one of my bosses one time who used to get up in front of our brigade and say, you know, if you haven't loved every day in the military, you shouldn't be here. Well, I got to admit, I have not loved every day I served in the military, but most of them I did. And I just feel proud to have been able to do it. It's you always want to be part of something bigger than yourself. And I always thought that was what being an active duty and being a veteran is all about.
Dr. Crane, I have to just tell a quick story here. A few weeks ago, I interviewed the author of a new book on Robert E. Lee, who was a graduate, an honored graduate at West Point. And at the time, West Point, the only, I shouldn't say the only education, but the majority of the people there and what they were taught, what they were being educated in, was engineering. And So there's so many projects in the infrastructure across this country that are due to the work of the engineers of West Point graduates, aren't there?
No, that's true. I mean, that was the for a long time, it was the premier engineering school in the United States. And I mean, if you talk about nation building, it's an issue. People talk about Iraq and Afghanistan and the involvement of the American military and nation building there. Well, for the early days of the United States, the Army was the nation builder. It did the, like I said, it did the exploring. West Point educated engineers, especially in the first half of the 19th century, did a lot of the major. They ran the railroads. They did a lot of the work on the waterways. They really were responsible for developing the infrastructure for the spread across the continent.
You know, again, I go back to Robert E. Lee and the conversation of where Lee stands in history today. It's a little bit different than what it was maybe just a few years ago, but just kind of a trivia part of, something that you can think about in history is that there still are projects that Robert E. Lee engineered or other engineers from West Point in the first half of the 19th century that still exist today, which is just amazing. I want to go back through some of these eras in American history and talk about the contributions of the military. The Revolution and the New Nation, let's talk about that. What were some of the contributions?
Well, most of the signers, the Declaration, and those who were developing a constitution, most of them were veterans. Obviously, you know, George Washington and his involvement in the efforts to create a new nation. But after the period after the Revolution, of course, then we're talking about expanding the frontiers and the activities of the army, with the Indians and with other threats around the United States at the time. I mean, and just trying to explore the continent. I mean, we remember Lewis and Clark, people are aware of Lewis and Clark, but they might not be aware that Lewis and Clark were both, that Captain Meriwether Lewis is leading this expedition. And I think they're both captains, if I remember correctly, but that it's a heavily military, it's a military expedition to explore the continent. Zebulon Pike is another army officer who explores an important part of the new nation as well. They were the explorers, they were the surveyors, and again, they were the defenders of the frontier as well, as settlers also moved west. So you have this dual role, not only the military aspects, but also these nation-building responsibilities also.
The military wasn't very large in the late 18th century. I mean, even the Continental Army was not that large. I mean, there were a lot of militia members, state militia members. But when there actually was a United States Army that was established, and yesterday was the 246th anniversary of the establishment of the United States Marines, but there were not a lot of people who actually served in the military, were there?
No, it was not. It wasn't exactly a popular the job that people went out to search for. I mean, it was small. Again, West Point starts in 1802, and so you start to get the development of a technically proficient officer corps for engineers and artillery in particular early on. But generally, most of the people who serve would come right out of states. There was a certain assumption that elites would serve at least in the militia. So you still have a lot of things being done by state militias. So people are, you have a number of veterans who may not have been in the regular military, but they still served in their state and local militias. Military service was just something that people were expected to do, if only in a militia kind of role.
Yeah, there was no such thing as a draft, a military draft at that time. So
no.
What percentage of Americans in the late 18th century actually served in the military, whether it's militia or in the regular army?
That's I really can't give you a figure on that, but it's if you include the militias, it was pretty substantial. If you look at the Minuteman tradition in New England, for instance, and even the militias that rolled out against Indians in the South, it was a pretty some kind of military experience was fairly common. Not regular army kind of experience, but some kind of militia experience was fairly common, especially among there was this kind of sense that there was responsibility of those considered elites to be prepared to do kind of leadership role there as well. So it was a fairly common experience for some kind of military service. I mean, most presidents had something, even Abraham Lincoln had like a month of service in militia. So it's just fairly common for some sort of that kind of experience with almost all the key leaders.
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln, again, with limited experience, but the Black Hawk Wars in Illinois,
where
he was involved. National expansion, contributions that the military made for national expansion.
Again, a lot of the explorers, generally the way it started is you would send a military expedition into the new areas that were purchased or obtained. Of course, the Mexican, the victory in the Mexican War opens up a whole large section of the new United States. And at the same time that the military is creating, getting new territories, you've also got a lot of veterans who are actually building infrastructure, canals, railroads, that further this expansion as well. You start to develop this scattering of military posts as we move west, and of course communities will start to sprout up around these military posts. So the military is opening areas and planting itself in areas that the rest of the nation will then grow up around. It's a very important symbiotic relationship.
What about after the Civil War? I mean, obviously most people are aware of the combat, the fighting during the Civil War, but about the Reconstruction period?
The post-Civil War period is a very tough time for the Army, and the Army especially. You've got Reconstruction, where the Army is trying to enforce the new civil rights and laws, where they're really not large enough to really suppress the KKK and a lot of the terrorism going on against those new programs. They do their best, but the Army gets shrunk down, and it's a difficult challenge to get caught between the president and Congress, where the president wants to be very, President Johnson wants to be very more lenient against the South, and the radical Republicans are trying to hammer home the new civil rights, and the Army gets caught in the middle. The Army is getting used as strike breakers that's a very unhappy role. Both of those, both Reconstruction and strike breaking, are very unhappy roles for the Army. Eventually, the Posse Comitatus law will be passed in 1878, which says the Army can't do that anymore, and a lot of that role will then evolve down to state, what will become the National Guard and state forces. But it's a very unsettled time for the Army, with a bunch of missions that are very unpopular and very hard to do. And it's very low level of manning, makes it very difficult as well. But, the Army does what it's, as it always has, the Army is a servant of the nation, and the Army does what its political leaders tell it to do. And it does its best with those very, very unhappy missions that it gets during that time period.
The rise of industrial America, and I have to say that, that era, one of the first things that comes to mind is the construction of the Panama Canal. Talk about the military's role.
If you go to the cemetery at West Point, which is one of my favorite places in the world, if you go down the one of the central rows of some of the monuments there, there's this large rock, big large rock, and the name on there is George Goethals. And Goethals was the chief engineer who built the Panama Canal, and that particular rock is a chunk out of one of the rocks they excavated as they were building the Panama Canal. But at the same time that Goethals and other West Point trained engineers are building this canal, you've also got Dr. Walter Reed and a bunch of military doctors who are battling against malaria and yellow fever. So you've got this engineering advances from the military. You've got these scientific advances from the military. It's not without its costs. One doctor dies. He helps prove that mosquitoes are the ones passing the diseases, but it costs him his life. So it's not without cost. But so the Army is. It's not so that the whole. Again, it's a multi. Tiered effort to build a canal that's medical engineering. That's this period where America is kind of building its empire. Of course, we have obtained the Philippines, and you've got the military governors in the Philippines who are dealing initially with the insurrection and then with, again, more nation building in the Philippines. The involvement in the Panama, building the Panama Canal. They get involved in the Caribbean and Puerto Rico and Cuba, operations, Spanish-American War, which begins involved this American involvement with a lot of those Caribbean islands. But again, it's another expansion of the role of the American military in the international arena.
Mm-hmm. Let's move ahead to the 1930s, the Great Depression. This is before World War II, obviously, but what was the military doing the Depression?
Well, again, you've got great big cutbacks in the size of the military. It's very small, but they're doing things like the Civilian Conservation Corps is run by the military. A lot of the military helps build the camps for that. They're helping along with those particular programs to get out of the Depression. Probably the most valuable thing it does, to be honest, though, is a lot of the military education systems that are set up to get prepared for the big war that is coming. So they are involved domestically as much as they can to help out, but at the same time, they are still looking forward, and they realize that there's a deadly time, a challenging time ahead.
But again, the military was small. Before World War II, before America actually got involved, right?
Yes, that said before World War II, the U.S. Army is the 17th ranked in the world size-wise.
Mm. So it took, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Hitler's rise in Europe, for the United States to for the military to ramp up. But once it did, obviously that was a time when the entire nation, whether it was involved in military or it was involved in some type of service to the nation. What about after World War II, post-war U.S. development?
Yep. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was the important Supreme Court justice, wrote of his Civil War generation that they'd been touched with fire. And he contributed the massive advances that the United States makes after the Civil War with filling the continent with this spirit that all these veterans coming out of the Civil War with this new drive and fire. And you can make a similar argument with the World War II generation. They come out of World War II. You've got things like the GI Bill, which would give all kinds of new rights to veterans. And they start building homes and setting up businesses, and you have this explosion of energy that I mean, it's the beginning of the, you know, people call it the Pax Americana, as America now emerges in this, in the world stage. And you've got General Lucius Clay, who runs the rebuilding of Germany, and General Douglas MacArthur, who runs the rebuilding of Japan. The military is it's in this, again, this nation building role in the international arena. But at home, it's also, you've got all these World War II veterans that just, you know, this post-war prosperity is driven by the actions of these World War II veterans and what they bring to the, this, again, that they are also a tougher touch with fire.
And there's a reason they're called the Greatest Generation. Present day and its influence today.
I want to talk about the most maligned group of veterans, and that's the Vietnam veterans. And a book I recommend to everyone to read is a book called Stolen Valor by B.G. Burkett and Glenna Whitley. And it really describes how that particular group of veterans especially has been much maligned. And in many ways, they have performed better than the World War II generation. They were better educated. They were... Again, a lot of that, there's so much mythology about the World War, the Vietnam generation that, and like I said, and if you read that book, in many ways, they have been a stronger, they've been a more accomplished veterans group than even the World War II generation. And they have also brought a lot of things, and it's Vietnam's a different war, obviously, they were treated much differently when they came back to the United States, but that has not stopped a myriad of Vietnam veterans from doing great things for the United States as well. In many ways, it's more admirable because a lot of what they have done has not been, they as a group have not been appreciated like the World War II generation was. So I want to make sure that that group in particular gets a shout out for all that they have done. There is concern these days about what is called a civil military gap, that the demise, no more draft, that the volunteer army has become kind of a family business, that we're no longer having the same interchange of values. I remember a speech I heard from Colin Powell when I was going to the Command and General Staff College at Leavenworth, where he was concerned about the fact that without the draft, that we might no longer have this exchange of values between the military and civilian society as people transition from one to the other. There are some concerns about that, but I think that there's still a strong respect for the veteran community out there, and veterans continue to do great things. But there is, if you go, you look at the congressional leadership, the percentage of veterans is dropped. The number of children of the congressmen and senators, or there are fewer of them are going into the military as well. So there is definitely a lessening of this shared experience that we'll have to watch over time, see how that develops. It is a concern for many.
Retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Conrad Crane, Chief of Historical Services and Support at the Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. Dr. Crane, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it, and it's been an honor to be here, and it's a great subject to talk about. And I was proud to serve, and I'm sure that most other veterans out there are the same boat. We've done our best to... while we were serving, and we continue to serve when we get out. I think that sense, one of the things, the great things about being in the military, I think that sense of duty and purpose that you get when you're in uniform, you keep that when you get out. And I think it's a great thing for the country.
Thank you, Dr. Crane. Today it is Veterans Day. As we continue our conversation on military contributions to the nation, let's turn to healthcare. In fact, military medical support has been a big part of the response to fighting COVID-19. Joining us now is Army Colonel Laura Porter, a nurse practitioner and U.S. Army. She's with the U.S. Army Nurse Corps and is an officer, of course. Colonel Porter is currently a student at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Colonel Porter, thank you for being with us today. Now, I just mentioned a good example of military response in healthcare over the past 20 months. If you would, describe how the military has responded to this COVID pandemic.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me, and it's a pleasure to spend Veterans Day with you and with Dr. Crane, who is actually one of my faculty members at the Army War College. So we've responded in a lot of ways, and so certainly you've seen from a medical response, once we were asked by the Department of Defense to mobilize military forces for the pandemic crisis, we mobilized with certainly a lot of medical response elements, logistical response elements, even engineering, and some other support elements. And so when called upon, we initially set out to support with some large-scale temporary sites. We saw that in some significant urban areas, such as Boston, New York, and Chicago. And then once we and the Department of Defense were able to scope the situation better, we were able to scale that down and to provide more focused and targeted support to community hospitals that needed assistance, again, in areas like New York and Connecticut, Massachusetts, Texas. And we were even sent here to Pennsylvania to provide assistance. And so, you know, to me, it's really amazing that this was actually one of the largest domestic mobilizations in our history. And so, we are able to provide the, from my perspective, those medical assets that were desperately needed in a very critical time.
Something you just said, you know, one of the biggest in our history, mobilizations in our history. Obviously, as it's happening many times, people don't realize it until it becomes history. But I mean, that is significant when you're talking about one of the largest mobilizations in the nation's history.
Well, certainly domestic. And so I'll clarify that, domestic mobilizations within our history. And so we've certainly seen, especially with the elements of the National Guard coming up, we've seen the National Guard support their local states and local communities frequently with hurricane relief. I'm originally from Nebraska, so we see a lot with flooding and blizzard relief. Earthquakes, those sorts of natural disasters. And then as more assistance is needed and directed by the Department of Defense, FEMA, and those other organizations, other elements can be called in to assist. And so, you know, to have such a large scale domestic issue where we needed all hands on deck, as they say, was a bit profound. Normally, you tend to see things, again, in my opinion, as more of a local response that the states are able to address within their communities.
Yeah, you, when you were describing this, I have to admit that what it did remind me of is a disaster response, that when there are natural disasters or maybe even a national security issue someplace, but is it similar?
It is similar. And you know, the process goes through obviously a lot of authorities and authorizations. And so if requested, the military can, provide lots of different services, and that tends to be once approved, it is funneled through an emergency preparedness liaison officer, which every state has, and that individual serves as a conduit for communication between the Department of Defense, federal, state, and local governments to coordinate that assistance between all of the parties during that emergency response and event, just to, again, make sure all communication and services are coordinated appropriately. And so that process is handled and addressed for as long as the request is needed.
The Army Reserve and Army Reserve Medical Command played large roles in this as well. Maybe you can explain what roles they did play.
Well, certainly clinically. Once requested, the needs were identified. And so from a active duty National Guard and as well as reserve medical community, we were able to provide certainly physicians, primary care physicians, critical care physicians, pulmonologists, anesthesiologists, but unique to COVID, infectious disease officers and physicians were sent, as well as nursing support, critical care nurses, respiratory therapists, laboratory science officers were all sent. And then they were deployed out. And so that was an interesting challenge that we had. And the fact that when the military is usually mobilized, we often think of more combat or kinetic activity and trauma surgeons. And so it was a bit of a different slant for us, and one that we took on willingly. And so with the Army Reserve Medical Command, what ultimately happened is, again, once the requests were funneled down to us, we were able, along with our partners, to develop these teams within a two-week notice. It was amazing how quickly the requests were sent down to us, and we were able to mobilize. And I was watching all of this as I was coming home from deployment from Kuwait, and I was overseas when COVID broke out. And so seeing the response that the U.S. took, as well as in the United States, as well as overseas, to start trying to figure out how to mitigate this infectious disease was amazing. And so when I got back into the United States and was in quarantine at Fort Hood, Texas, I was watching all of my colleagues get the call. And for many of them, it was the first time that they had ever been able to really support their nation in something other than a training or exercise environment, and to see the pride that they took at being able to serve that call was amazing. And so with what Army Reserve Medical Command does is we not only help provide those assets, those medical support assets when requested, but our main job is to ensure the readiness of the entire Medical Reserve Force, as well as the active duty force, in providing state-of-the-art simulation training, exercise. We validate the training and skills that the medical personnel have to ensure that they're ready to go whenever they're needed.
You're a nurse practitioner. What is the role of a nurse practitioner in the military?
It is, in essence, the same as in the civilian world. We provide primary care and diagnostic capabilities for patients. We see patients in outpatient settings, so in clinics within, like I said, primary care as well as specialty care. You'll see us in the emergency rooms, urgent care centers. Nurse anesthetists are a form of a nurse practitioner, and so you'll see them obviously in the operating room, and same as midwives delivering babies. And so we perform those same clinical skills. And then in addition to the military, what's different is that I still have soldier skills that I have to maintain. And so I'm not often asked by my civilian employer to go out and take a 2-mile run, and they time me on it, or how many push-ups I can do. But they certainly do that for me in the military. And so, you know, our job is to make sure that not only are we clinically competent to be able to provide that direct patient care, but also to make sure that we can still perform those soldier skills, as well as the administrative and leadership skills that are required as we advance within the military ranks. And that's certainly what has brought me to the Army War College, is to continue on with that professional military education.
A 2-mile run, I think they'd cut you a break from time to time with everything else you have to do. But, you know, in wartime, we know that there is the need for trauma surgeons, as you mentioned, anesthesiologists. But in peacetime, okay, we no longer are in Afghanistan. You mentioned being deployed to Kuwait. Are there a lot of professionals in the healthcare field in the military?
Absolutely. I think people would be surprised to know that at least on the Army Reserve, we make over the medical community in and of itself in total, doctors, nurses, et cetera, make up over half of all of the medical assets for the entire Army force. And so we really rely heavily on what we call citizen soldiers and those individuals like myself. I'm a traditional reservist that bounce between our civilian requirements as well as the military requirements. And as Dr. Crane alluded to, we have the people that join the military have a passion for serving. And as healthcare individuals, we have a passion to serve even further. And so we see a strong element of healthcare professionals that do want to serve in the military. And you know, we're able to balance that and we're happy to provide that medical care for our families and for our fellow soldiers during peacetime activities. And then we very quickly can transition into that operational environment if we need to.
Okay, you mentioned you are a traditional reservist. That's one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. How do you balance your life in that way?
It's tough. And in the reserve community, sometimes we often say that, you know, we don't do it because we get paid. We do it because we love it and call it love time, because it does require a significant amount of time personally away from our families, away from our civilian jobs, in order to do something that clearly we're all passionate about. And so it's a matter of really having that really strong foundational support, not only from our families, but also from our employers. I've been deployed and mobilized over four times for overseas duties in Afghanistan and Germany, Qatar, and Kuwait. And then now I'm here at the Army War College for a year. And that's a lot of burden on our employers. And there is absolutely no way any National Guard or Reserve soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine could do that without having that strong support from the employers. And I think they realize that they are getting a benefit out of it as well, because we are able to learn different techniques. We have different perspectives in how we treat illness and injury because of our experiences. And more importantly, we have, you know, a very strong foundation in leadership that the Army and military in general is able to instill in us. And so we're able to carry that resource back over into our civilian occupations for their benefit. Mm-hmm.
Army Colonel Laura Porter, she's a nurse practitioner and part of the U.S. Army Nurse Corps. Colonel Porter is currently a student at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Colonel Porter, thank you very much for being with us today, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.